More unrest around Minneapolis as police body cam footage shows how an unarmed black man was shot and killed during a traffic stop. The question is, what repercussions will follow what appears to be a tragic mistake? And just a few miles away, the state of Minnesota is expected to wrap its case against the officer accused of killing George Floyd. As the defense begins to call its first witnesses, the question is, will Derek Chauvin testify? Plus, the Biden administration strikes a new international deal to help stem the increasing flow of migrants at the southern border. The question is this anything more than a temporary fix? It's way too early for this. Good morning and welcome to Way Too Early, the show that is guiding you through another tough day of news. I am Casey Hunt on this Tuesday, April 13th, and we will start with the news. We're learning new details about the police-involved shooting of a black man during a traffic stop in a Minneapolis suburb on Sunday. The Brooklyn Center Police Department has released body camera footage showing the moment that 20-year-old Dante Wright was shot and killed. Police say he was pulled over for expired tags when police discovered he had a warrant out for his arrest. A warning before we show that footage, it's upsetting and graphic. Here is what happened when police tried to take Wright into custody. At a news conference yesterday, Brooklyn Center Police Chief Tim Gannon said he believes the shooting was, quote, accidental.
For informational purposes, we train with our handguns on our dominant side and our taser on our weak side. So if you're right-handed, you carry your firearm on your right side and you carry your taser on the left. This is done purposefully and is trained. As I watch the video and listen to the officer's commands, it is my belief that the officer had the intention to deploy their taser, but instead shot Mr. Wright with a single bullet. This appears to me, from what I've viewed and the officer's reaction and distress immediately after, that this was an accidental discharge that resulted in the tragic death of Mr. Wright.
The officer who discharged her firearm has now been identified as Kim Potter, a 26-year veteran of the Brooklyn Center Police Department. She's been placed on standard administrative leave. Meanwhile, an autopsy report confirms that Wright died of a gunshot wound to the chest and lists his manner of death as homicide. And for the second night in a row, violent protests gripped a Minneapolis suburb in the wake of that deadly shooting Sunday night. Police in Brooklyn Center used tear gas on unruly protesters after they set off fireworks and hurled objects at officers on the scene. According to the Minnesota State Patrol, some officers suffered minor injuries. At least 40 arrests were made overnight as reports of looting in the area remained limited. Two armored law enforcement vehicles were rolled out to subdue the crowds who were out past the 7 p.m. curfew. More than 1,000 Minnesota National Guard troops were also deployed to the area. President Joe Biden addressed the deadly shooting in Minnesota yesterday and urged protesters to remain peaceful.
Prayers with their family is really a tragic thing that happened. But I think we got to wait and see what the investigation shows and the entire investigation. You all watched, I assume, as I did, the film, which is fairly the body cam, which is fairly graphic. The question is, was it an accident? Was it intentional? That remains to be determined by a full-blown investigation. But in the meantime, I want to make it clear again, there is absolutely no justification, none, for looting, no justification for violence.
Vice President Kamala Harris tweeted in part, quote, "Prayers are not enough. Dante's family needs to know why their child is dead. They deserve answers." Joining us now, White House correspondent for Politico and co-author of The Playbook, Eugene Daniels. He is also an MSNBC contributor. Eugene, good morning. Let's talk first about what the president had to say in response to this, taking a measured tone in how he approached this and mentioning that protesters should stay peaceful. And we should, of course, underscore this is all taking place against the backdrop of the Derek Chauvin trial, who, of course, he is charged in the killing of George Floyd. And that really has emotions running so much higher. All right. It sounds like we may have lost Eugene Daniels' audio there, but we will try and get him back to continue our conversation. Let's go now to that other news story we were just discussing. In the last full day of testimony in the prosecution's case against Derek Chauvin, the jury heard testimony yesterday from a police use of force expert who said Chauvin's actions were not, quote, reasonable.
It's clear from the number of officers and Mr. Floyd's position, the fact that he's handcuffed and has been searched, he doesn't present a threat of harm. Someone who does not have a pulse does not present a threat in any way. No reasonable officer would have believed that that was an appropriate, acceptable, or reasonable use of force.
The day began with a defense motion to sequester the jury due to protests in the wake of the police shooting of Dante Wright in nearby Brooklyn Center. With at least one juror having ties to the area, the defense argued that the jury could be biased against Chauvin. Judge Cahill denied the motion. The jury then heard testimony from George Floyd's brother about the man his family lost. Also testifying, expert cardiologist Jonathan Rich on whether drugs caused Floyd's death.
He just was like a person that everybody loved around the community. He just knew how to make people feel better. Being around him, he showed us like how to treat our mom and how to respect our mom. He loved her so dearly.
I can state with a high degree of medical certainty that George Floyd did not die from a primary cardiac event, and he did not die from a drug overdose.
Taking into account all of the evidence that you reviewed, do you have an opinion to a reasonable degree of medical certainty as to whether Mr. Floyd's death was preventable?
I believe that Mr. George Floyd's death was absolutely preventable.
The prosecution is expected to rest today, and the defense will likely call its first witness. All right, I think we've got Politico's Eugene Daniels back with us. Eugene, again, thanks for being here this morning. Let's go back to President Biden's statement about what happened in Brooklyn Center. He was kind of treading pretty carefully.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what you expect from Joe Biden. He did the exact same thing when George Floyd was killed last year, right, in Minnesota. It's something that when I talk to advocates and activists, tensions are really running high. Both of these happened, as you said, in the exact same state. It's happened. The Dante Wright was killed while George Floyd's the Derek Chauvin case was going through. And after his and yesterday, we saw his brother, as you just showed, with that kind of heart-wrenching testimony. And so people are already feeling very tense in the city. And Joe Biden does have to tread carefully here because presidents typically try to make sure they don't weigh in too much before an investigation happens. But at the same time, this is a president and a vice president who have talked a lot about policing, who have talked about the need to get things done. And so advocates, activists, and protesters are expecting to hear from them no matter what happens after it does happen. And it's going to put more pressure on Biden to push Congress to pass the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act.
Yeah, so let's pick up right there, because in the wake of what happened with George Floyd last year, there was some movement. At the time, Republicans controlled the Senate, and Senator Tim Scott was a leading voice on this. But in the end, Congress did nothing, honestly, we've come to find they seem to do at many, many difficult moments the country's faced over the past couple of years. Is there any chance that with the filibuster still in place in the Senate that they're able to do anything to make changes to policing and the rules that govern it?
Yeah, it's, I mean, you and I both know it just seems really hard to see. You know, there's getting 10 Republicans on board for justice, the Justice and Policing Act, any kind of bill that would look at or change the way that policing is handled in this country. Republicans have already balked for months about parts of this bill that would take away police immunity when it comes to police shootings. And that's something that they don't seem to be budging on in the House or the Senate. And it's not clear what can make them change. And like you talked about the filibuster, and I know viewers are probably sick of hearing about this kind of arcane Senate rule that most of us in whether you're a reporter or not, hadn't really paid a lot of attention to for a very long time. But it's taking up a lot of the oxygen because unless Democrats can find 10 Republicans for every single bill, or they get rid of the filibuster. People who do get rid of the filibuster say none of it matters.
All right. Eugene Daniels, thank you very much for being with us this morning. We really appreciate your time and your reporting. And still ahead here, how the sports world is reacting to the shooting death of 20-year-old Daunte Wright. And later, will former United Nations Ambassador Nikki Haley run for the White House in 2024? Apparently not, if Donald Trump does. We're going to have those stories and much more when we come right back.
On the MSNBC podcast, How to Win 2024, political experts former Senator Claire McCaskill and Democratic strategist Jennifer Palmieri examine the campaign strategies unfolding in this all-important election.
The focus is on the voters that are not necessarily in your corner now.
If Democrats are going to win in 2024, we have to be able to explain what is happening at the border and what the solutions are.
Search for How to Win 2024 wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes every Thursday.
Hey everyone, it's MSNBC's Chris Hayes. For the first time since 1892, we have an election in which both candidates have presidential records. It's a chance to take a hard look at what Joe Biden and Donald Trump have actually done as president. On a special Why Is This Happening podcast series called With Pod 2024 The Stakes, I'm talking to experts about the two candidates' records on specific policy areas like immigration, taxes, climate, and more. So you know what's at stake come November. Search for Why Is This Happening and follow.
Welcome back. Minnesota sports teams called off their scheduled home games yesterday in response to the police-involved shooting of Daunte Wright near Minneapolis on Sunday. Major League Baseball's Twins were the first to postpone, having already taken the field for warm-ups along with the visiting Red Sox prior to the announcement. Today's Twins game also seems likely to be postponed, with an added threat of weather delays for the afternoon start that's part of the team's home stand scheduled through Thursday. The NBA's Timberwolves followed as Minnesota's governor issued a curfew in anticipation of unrest. Originally slated to host the Brooklyn Nets last night, the T-Wolves did not immediately announce a makeup date. And the NHL's Wild announced last night's matchup against the St. Louis Blues has been rescheduled for next month. All three Minnesota teams again have home games scheduled for tomorrow. Additionally, Major League Soccer's Minnesota United postponed its virtual season kickoff, quote, out of respect for the tragic events that occurred in our Twin Cities community. The story reverberated across sports outside of Minnesota as well. Former Twins outfielder Aaron Hicks sat out last night's game for the Yankees against the Blue Jays. And before tip-off of the Orlando Magic's NBA home game against the San Antonio Spurs, players, coaches, and referees formed a circle at center court, locking arms and bowing their heads in a moment of solidarity. Here's what Spurs head coach Greg Popovich told KSAT News before the game.
This makes you sick to your stomach. You know, it's how many times does it have to happen? And you know, it's as sick to our stomachs as we might feel. You know, that individual's dead. He's dead. And his family's grieving, and his friends are grieving. And we just keep moving on as if nothing's happening.
Always been very outspoken about these types of issues. All right, time now for the weather. Let's go to meteorologist Bill Cairns for a check on the forecast. Bill, good morning.
Hey, good morning to you, Casey. And you did mention that storm and the weather near Minnesota. They're getting snow in northern Minnesota, and it's kind of a cold and raw storm system, not just from Minnesota, but also our friends in the Dakotas, too. Everyone in the Northeast has been complaining about the weather the last couple of days. That rainy system is exiting today. The sun will return, especially as we go throughout the late morning and afternoon, many areas, including New York City. Then all the trouble will be with this next storm system that's already brought some rain through Dallas. So later on today, our friends in areas, especially southern Louisiana. This is where we have a severe weather threat, including the New Orleans area, Baton Rouge to Lake Charles, and even areas around Lufkin, Texas. We could see isolated tornado, but wind damage and large hail also could do some significant damage, and maybe even some flash flooding, too, locally up to 5 inches possible in that area between New Orleans, Baton Rouge to Alexandria, and southern portions of Minnesota near Macomb. So today's forecast, there's a little bit more of that warmth and sun in the Northeast, 66 in D.C., 60 in New York. Florida looks great. There's the storms from Dallas to New Orleans. That chilly weather stays in place from Montana all the way through Minneapolis. And a sneak peek at tomorrow's forecast shows, unfortunately, that rain returning, Casey, to the mid-Atlantic area as that cold chill remains in the northern plains. So kind of a typical April up and down forecast as we kind of continue to watch areas of rain and chill.
Indeed. Springtime for sure. All right, Bill Cairns, thank you very much for that. We really appreciate it. I'll see you tomorrow. And still ahead here, the Biden administration comes to an agreement with several South American countries to tighten border security. We're going to get a report from Guatemala, where thousands of migrants are trying to make it to the United States. We'll be back in just a moment.
Today's news requires more facts, more context, and more analysis. The world's never been harder to understand. That's why it's never been more important to try. MSNBC. Understand more.
So Mexico made the decision to maintain 10,000 troops at its southern border, resulting in twice as many daily migrant interdictions. Guatemala surged 1,500 police and military personnel to its southern border with Honduras and agreed to set up 12 checkpoints along the migratory route. Honduras surged 7,000 police and military to disperse a large contingent of migrants.
Welcome back. That was White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki announcing that the Biden administration has struck a deal with the governments of Mexico, Honduras, and Guatemala to temporarily increase border security. MSNBC anchor Ayman Mohedin is in Guatemala covering the migrant crisis and filed this report for us.
Hey, good morning, Casey. You know, as the Biden administration grapples with the record number of migrants making their way across the U.S. southern border, we came here to Guatemala to see firsthand the conditions that are forcing people to make that perilous journey across Mexico. We also had a chance to speak to the Guatemalan president about what he hopes would be a new chapter in U.S.-Guatemalan relations. But I can tell you from just spending a few days here on the ground, both in Guatemala City and going to the rural parts of the country, that the situation is dire. People here are facing desperate conditions economically as well as environmentally. You know, we went just outside of the capital, spent a few hours with a small rural village, a community there, a young mother of two children, both of her kids malnourished, despite the fact that her husband works in the seasonal sugarcane farms. But it does highlight the problems this country is facing. 50% of the children here are malnourished. There is an acute food shortage, according to the World Food Program. 3.7 million people are living with food insecurity. And that's just some of the challenges that they have to face. There are aspects of governance that are also making life here unbearable. We asked the Guatemalan president about these challenges. And quite honestly, there is rampant corruption that he acknowledged. There are challenges with organized crime as well as trafficking that have made people here lose confidence that their government is going to be able to improve their condition. Now, a part of the surge, though, that is unfolding in the border, along the border, between the U.S. and Mexico, he said was as a result of the messaging that is coming out of the Biden administration. And to that point, he said that the message about compassion allowed the traffickers here to exploit that and try to recruit more migrants to make it to the United States. He's not faulting the Biden administration, but he is saying that message was confusing and was exploited by traffickers. I asked him if he wanted the United States to provide more assistance in fighting organized crime and traffickers. He said he didn't expect Congress to allow America to have any kind of military presence here, but he certainly welcomed money and technical and any other kind of assistance that could help reverse the tide in his ability to try and control the situation and improve the quality of lives for the millions of Guatemalans who see no other choice but having to leave and make that perilous journey across Mexico to the United States. Casey?
Very difficult indeed. Our thanks to Ayman Mohideen for that report. All right, still ahead here. President Biden hosted a bipartisan meeting yesterday to discuss his $2 trillion infrastructure deal. Will it be enough to convince Republicans to get on board? That's next. But before we go to break, we want to know, as always, why are you awake on this Tuesday? Email us your reasons for being up and watching to waytooearly at msnbc.com or drop me a tweet at Casey. Use the hashtag waytooearly and we'll read our favorite answers coming up later on in the show. Way too early. It is just before 5:30 here on the East Coast, 2:30 out West. I'm Casey Hunt. The committee in charge of helping Republicans win back the Senate has named former President Donald Trump as the inaugural recipient of its Champion of Freedom Award. The award recognizes, quote, conservative leaders who have worked tirelessly to create good jobs, protect the values that make our country great, and stop the Democrat socialist agenda. It was presented on the same weekend that Trump tore into Minority Leader Mitch McConnell at an event at Mar-a-Lago amid heightened tensions between the two after McConnell condemned Trump for his role in the Capitol insurrection. The award does signal Trump will likely play a role in Republican primaries for years to come, though not every Senate Republican was pleased with the choice. Senator Mitt Romney of Utah told reporters, quote, not my call. They're certainly free to do whatever they'd like to do. As you know, having voted twice to remove him from office, that would not have been my preference. That photo of him receiving the bull in honor of this is quite a picture. And another sign of the odd place in which the Republican Party finds itself in the wake of Trump, this time evidenced by former UN Ambassador Nikki Haley. After the Capitol riot, she was profiled by Politico's Tim Alberta. The piece was called Nikki Haley's Time for Choosing. The 2024 hopeful can't decide who she wants to be, the leader of a post-Trump GOP, or a friend to the president who tried to sabotage democracy. In that piece, the former South Carolina governor seemed sure that Trump's political career was over, saying, quote, he's not going to run for federal office again. When asked if the Republican Party can heal with Trump in the picture, she said, quote, I don't think he's going to be in the picture. I don't think he can. He's fallen so far. She added, quote, we need to acknowledge he let us down. He went down a path he shouldn't have, and we shouldn't have followed him, and we shouldn't have listened to him. We can't let that ever happen again. All right, let's compare that with what she told reporter Meg Kennard of the Associated Press yesterday. Watch this.
He still has a lot of popularity. If he runs again in 2024, will you support him?
Yes.
If he decides that he's going to run, would that preclude any sort of run that you would possibly make yourself?
I would not run if President Trump ran. And I would talk to him about it. You know, I mean, that's something that we'll have a conversation about at some point if that decision is something that has to be made. But yeah, I would absolutely. I had a great working relationship with him. I appreciated the way he let me do my job. I thought we did some fantastically great foreign policy things together.
Well, then, polls show Donald Trump is the consistent favorite among Republicans for the 2024 presidential nomination. And President Joe Biden hosted an Oval Office meeting with a group of bipartisan lawmakers yesterday to see if they could build any compromise on his $2.3 trillion infrastructure package. In comments before the meeting, the president noted that negotiations may come down to the actual definition of infrastructure. Watch.
I'm prepared to negotiate as to how the extent of my infrastructure project, as well as how we pay for it. But if we get in a serious conversation about how to do that, I think everyone acknowledges we need significant increase in infrastructure. It's going to get down to what we call infrastructure.
Some Republicans say that they're concerned about being window dressing, Mr. President.
I'm not big on window dressing, if you've observed. Thank you very much.
After the meeting, the top Republican and Democrat on the Senate Commerce Committee, Senators Roger Wicker and Maria Cantwell, agreed the Oval Office discussion was good, but plenty of progress is still needed. Senator Wicker did note, however, that reversing the GOP's 2017 corporate tax cut to help pay for the bill would be a non-starter for Republicans. All right, joining us now, the co-founder of Punchbowl News, Jake Sherman. He is also an MSNBC political contributor. Jake, good morning. Good to see you. Let's talk a little bit about that meeting at the White House yesterday. Obviously, Republicans were willing to go down to Pennsylvania Avenue and listen to what the president had to say. But at the end of the day, it does seem to me that this is an attempt to demonstrate on the part of the White House that they are reaching out. But that said, the dynamics of how this is ultimately going to play out seem pretty set. And that's that it's very unlikely Republicans are going to support this package.
Extraordinarily. And I can assure you one thing, Casey, it will not come down in any way to what they call infrastructure. That has nothing to do with the Republican opposition in any way, shape or form. The Republican opposition is that quote you showed from Roger Wicker, which is Republicans are unwilling, completely unwilling to undo the 2017 tax law to pay for this bill. That's just not something they're willing to do. And I don't know if that's going to change. I don't think it's going to change. And I know people will point, the administration will point to Mitt Romney and say, well, Mitt Romney is willing to raise the corporate rate to 25. But Mitt Romney is not indicative of the Republican Party. In fact, quite the opposite. He's indicative of nothing about the current Senate Republican conference. And we have in Punchbowl News' AM edition this morning, we have a rundown of all the outreach the administration has been doing on this bill. And I understand they're doing a lot and they're trying to get people on board. But they also, frankly, this is I'm not trying to impugn bad motives here, and I don't think they have bad motives. But at the end of the day, they're going to try to lay this at Republicans' feet if they don't come along, obviously, because this is Joe Biden's top legislative priority. And Biden does view Congress through a lens of his time in the Congress in the 80s and 90s and early 2000s, when infrastructure was bipartisan. Nothing is bipartisan anymore, Casey, as you know well. So we're just in a different era in which, you know, it's going to be very difficult to get bipartisanship on this.
Certainly these large priorities that then become the subject of midterm campaign ads are very rarely, it seems, bipartisan any longer, for sure. Jake, let's talk for a second about what we saw in Florida over the weekend and what we just heard from Nikki Haley. I mean, that photo of Rick Scott handing Donald Trump a little bowl to give him an award from the National Republican Senatorial Committee was pretty widely mocked on Twitter. Then you have Nikki Haley, of course, as we just showed everyone, saying, oh, I would ask President Trump, I would talk to him before I ever ran. If this is the state of play for the Republican Party, I struggle to see what the future is in terms of actually getting a working or governing majority in the near term.
Well, Casey, it's embarrassing for the NRSC to be giving an award to somebody who has said, if not directly, has certainly indicated that he might challenge sitting Republican senators. The NRSC is designed to protect sitting Republican senators. Donald Trump has said he will primarily Murkowski. So I don't understand what is going on here. This is embarrassing for the NRSC. If I were a sitting Senate Republican, I'd be furious that they gave an award, however meaningless it is, to somebody who is vowing to oppose sitting Republican senators. And listen, Nikki Haley, I think she seems lost quite clearly. She told Tim Alberta, my former colleague at Politico, who has now moved on to The Atlantic, that he has that Donald Trump has no future in the party. Now she's saying she wouldn't run against him and she would support him for president in 2024. So she clearly seems a bit adrift here and confused about either her role or the Republican Party writ large.
Yeah, and it's worth pointing out, of course, that Mitch McConnell's the super PAC that with ties to Mitch McConnell is already on the other side of Donald Trump in that race that you mentioned. Going to be quite a midterm campaign season. Punchbowl News' Jake Sherman, thank you very much for getting up early with us. It's always good to see you. Thanks for being here. And still ahead, Hamilton creator Lin-Manuel Miranda's totally different return to Broadway. Don't go anywhere. Way too early. Back in just a moment.
We want to gather again, and we want to tell stories in the dark. We cannot do that if we don't feel safe, and if you don't feel safe. So the first step in that process is getting our vaccination shots, and the next steps will follow.
Time now for something totally different. That was Hamilton creator Lin-Manuel Miranda speaking at the grand opening of a new Times Square COVID-19 vaccination site for entertainment industry workers. This is the first step in Mayor Bill de Blasio's plan to reopen Broadway by September. Housed in a former NFL experience shop, the facility will be run by the longtime company manager of the musical Wicked and will be open to all city workers involved in theater, film, and television. Get those shots. So excited about that. All right. The biggest night in fashion is coming back with a bang. Making up for last year, the Met Gala plans to return in person this September, and then again in its usual slot the following May. Known for its star-studded guest list and out-there costumes, the first gala this fall will be more intimate in accordance with coronavirus guidelines, followed by a larger-scale event in 2022. Both will launch their own exhibition to be on the display at the Met for a year, celebrating the 75th anniversary of the museum's Costume Institute. Finally, kind of getting back to some sense of normalcy. And as pandemic restrictions ease, there does seem to be a lot more traffic around, and we're not just talking about cars. Chinese officials have launched what they say is the world's first traffic signal for camels. The country's Gansu province has become popular with tourists in recent years, and camel riding tours are apparently an especially big attraction. According to state media, the signal was installed on Sunday, with the green light meaning it's safe for camels to cross, and the red light signaling it's safe for humans to cross. No word yet on whether that signal is particularly effective or not. And in other animal news, Major Biden is set to receive professional help adjusting to his new surroundings. The president's three-year-old German Shepherd has found himself in the doghouse on more than one occasion, making headlines after a pair of biting incidents last month. Both incidents were deemed minor by the White House, but now it's been confirmed that Major will go through a few weeks of professional training off-site to help him better cope with his new duties as first dog. He is a very good boy. And last year, Home Alone star Macaulay Culkin made the whole world collectively feel old when he turned 40. And now, Kevin McAllister, forever a kid in most of our minds, is officially a dad. Culkin and his partner, actress Brenda Song, welcomed a baby boy, Dakota Song Culkin, on April 5th. Dakota is named after Culkin's late sister, who died in a car accident in 2008. The couple released a brief statement saying, quote, "We're overjoyed. Congratulations to them." All right, still ahead here, the emotional response from Dante Wright's mother after police described her son's death as an accident. And as we go to break, a look at this date in history. 51 years ago, Apollo 13, 4/5 of the way to the moon, was crippled when a tank containing liquid oxygen burst.
Apollo 13, its power sources badly damaged, its mission to the moon ended, its astronauts under a strain more severe than any others have yet endured, begins its return to Earth tonight, landing in the Pacific Ocean, 1,500 miles northeast of New Zealand, shortly after noon Friday, if all goes well.
And I just need everyone to know that he was my life. He was my son. And I could never get that back. Because of a mistake. Because of an accident.
Welcome back. That was Katie Wright, the mother of 20-year-old Dante Wright, who was shot and killed by police during a traffic stop near Minneapolis on Sunday. Joining us now, MSNBC political analyst Juanita Tolliver. Juanita, good morning. It's great to have you here, although it's just there are not words to describe how discouraging it is that we are back here again talking about this, the death of a black man at the hands of police. They're saying it's an accident, but at this point, the officer that shot him still remains on leave. There was pressure during that press conference yesterday for her to be fired. Where do we go next from here? Can she keep her job at the police department? And what changes need to be made to the policing, especially in this area where, of course, we're already seeing the Derek Chauvin trial as the backdrop for this latest set of events?
Good morning, Casey. And you're absolutely right. This is another heartbreaking moment with this unarmed young black man being murdered by police. And what I think is most shocking is after the police chief described this as an accident of a seasoned veteran, this is a police officer with 26 years of service behind her. And couldn't tell the difference between the weight of a loaded gun and a taser. Also couldn't recognize that a taser nor a gun should be pulled in a traffic stop. And so I think what comes next is the accountability that we saw Vice President Harris share. Vice President Harris named on social media last night that Dante's family needs to understand why this happened, and an accident is insufficient in describing and defining what we know to be yet another tragedy. I do appreciate you mentioning the Chauvin trial that's ongoing right now, because it highlights the compounded trauma that not only Black people across the country are experiencing, but this community that is just in the suburbs, 10 miles away from where that trial is happening. And what it's highlighting, that trauma specifically in this case for me, is that Dante called his mother because he knew that he should be scared. It's the fact that now his mother is saying and calling out the police, rightfully saying that this accident, calling this a mistake, is insufficient when it has resulted in a tragic loss for her, a son that she'll never see again, a son she'll never talk to again, a son who was so afraid in that moment that he knew to call his mother because this might be his last moment on this earth. And so looking ahead, accountability is a must, but none of that equals justice, because justice in the situation is Dante making it home, and Dante didn't. And so at this point, it is about accountability for the police chief who demonstrated a degree of bias at that press conference, for this 26-year police veteran who couldn't tell the difference between a gun and a taser at this traffic stop as well.
It's a very the fact that he was pulled over for expired tags, especially at a time when so many people struggle to even get tags in the pandemic. And this is the result. Juanita, what's the significance of the medical examiner classifying his death as a homicide?
Highly significant, because it's the first time documented that he was killed, and this is considered a homicide. And while that doesn't have legal weight per se, it does have an impact on acknowledging the loss of his life at the hands of police.
All right, Juanita Tolliver, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks,
today.
Casey.
We really appreciate your time. All right. Earlier on in the show, we asked all of you, why are you awake? One viewer tweeted, I'm awake because my cat discovered the tassels on my PJs. Thanks, Pip. Hello. Very cute. Mike is up fasting while marking the first full day of Ramadan. Thank you for being here with us. And John emails, today is my husband's birthday and we are headed to the beach to catch the sunrise. It's a tradition we've been doing for years. One of my favorite things about getting up this time of day, you get to catch the sunrise. Thanks for watching. All right, coming up next here, we're going to take a look at the Axios One Big Thing. And coming up on Morning Joe, former Republican House Speaker John Boehner will join the conversation. Don't go anywhere. Morning Joe, just moments away.
Hey everyone, it's Chris Hayes. This week on my podcast, Why Is This Happening? We're back with another installment of our special series with Pod 2024, The Stakes. I'm talking to experts about both Joe Biden and Donald Trump's records on specific policy areas during their time as president. This week, economist Kim Clausing on taxes.
Underfunding the IRS really serves the interest of dishonest people at the top rather than your typical worker who would benefit from being able to get their questions answered and getting their returns processed in a quick way.
That's this week on Why Is This Happening? Search for Why Is This Happening wherever you're listening right now and follow.